Hello and welcome to Accountability Talks with AGA. I'm your host, Paul Marshall. All right, so today we are diving into a historical case study. We'll look at it that way. And we'll tell you what that is in a minute. But first, let's say hello to our guest, Brian Tai. Hi, Brian. How are you doing today?
Doing well, Paul. Good. Glad to be here.
All right. Happy to see you. So what we're going to talk today about is there was a little bit of a crisis with some agencies that depend on user fees. And, you know, Brian's from DHS, so he's going to tell us about that and maybe just, you know, in general, some agencies that had that issue and maybe one in particular. And yeah, this was because of COVID. You know, we thought that talk was over, but it's right. Not. But yeah, why don't we just start, Brian? Give us a little bit about just yourself, and then maybe what your job is over there at DHS.
So I've been with the agency about 7 years. I'm a budget analyst at DHS headquarters. Prior to that, actually, I was a returned Peace Corps volunteer serving 2 years as a teacher in Ghana. So,
oh wow!
Fortunately, the department was able to have me.
That's awesome. So, and did you do anything before that, or were you like right out of school into the Peace Corps kind of thing?
So I was studying engineering, aerospace engineering over at Florida Tech. Cool. I was in my last year as a SGA president, student government president. And I was thinking, you know, I loved public service so much. Mm-hmm. I was thinking, you know, I'm going to make oodles of money as an engineer. Maybe I'll take a few years to step away, pay it forward a little bit. Joined the Peace Corps, and I loved it so much. I said, you know what, let me keep going.
Yeah.
And funny enough, the budget analyst role at DHS headquarters was the first one on the list, and I just swooped in. Got right into it and have never stopped.
All right. Well, happy you did, because it sounds like you did some good work over there. So you actually wrote an article, too, for AGA. It's been a few journals back, right? So in this kind of, you know, the subject we're covering today, so however you want to do it, just kind of, we can deep dive into that or just give us more perspectives. But, yeah, maybe I'll let you tell the story. What did you start to see back in them COVID days and kind of what happened?
Yeah. Man, I don't know if I want to reopen some old wounds for people.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, COVID happened, you know, towards the tail end of 2019, at the onset of 2020. And I'll say this, right, like, this is certainly coming from my perspective, and I'm sure that this experience will resonate with a lot of other departments, but I'm only going to be able to provide a small little bit of history, at least from DHS's perspective.
Sure.
But, I mean, I think the word that people throw out for that time frame was unprecedented, right? I think, you know, at the onset, I remember talking with a few colleagues who were saying, oh, how long do you think this is going to go? Some people said a couple weeks.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. And I think, you know, me personally, I said, oh, I don't know, maybe 3 months, June.
Yeah.
And people were saying, that's too far. You're being a worry wart. But obviously, like hindsight being 2020, that has definitely not been the case, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of going at the onset, people were obviously going social distancing. We were going remote. I remember the first indications of some of this user fee crisis happening, you know, while I was at my, you know, parents' house in my old bedroom while we were all doing the telework situation. And the budget officer over at USCIS gives me a call, right? He says, hey, Brian, I'm seeing some problems. I think we'll be able to manage it, but I'm going to keep you updated. No worries now.
Interesting.
Said, cool. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate the update.
Right.
Let me know if there's anything I can do. You know, a couple weeks later, he says, hey, Brian, we're having problems, right? What we saw wasn't just delays in fees. We're actually seeing actual, you know, decreases in receipts.
Yeah.
It's not recovering.
Right.
So at that point, you start flagging the alarms, right, where budget officers start giving you calls and telling them they're having problems. You want to make sure that your leadership is in the know. At that point, I think, you know, other desk officers at the department were starting to see problems as well. One of my colleagues, Rob Bixler, who was a detailee from the Coast Guard, started helping put together some analysis, and I was helping him as well. But, you know, we were talking with a lot of the other components. evaluating the 36 fees that we had under our portfolio at the time, and some rudimentary analysis showed early indications of $4 billion some decreased or deferred revenue.
Yeah. So you say 36 fees, is that for one agency or one bureau or multiple?
Multiple, gotcha, across six components.
Six components, okay.
And we refer to our agencies as components.
Gotcha. So yeah, we're talking CIS, CBP?
ICE, TSA, U.S. Coast Guard, and FEMA.
Okay. So you're seeing it across the board already. And I mean, how soon is this, or what, is this 2020, early 2020, middle? Do you remember kind of when it happened?
Yeah, around the April timeframe.
April already of 2020. Okay. I mean, that's like right away, right? Because I think March or so is when they started doing the stay-at-home kind of stuff, right?
For us, right? But if you start thinking about travelers, that indication started coming out very early.
Yeah, and so much about DHS is travel, right? I mean, TSA.
Exactly.
People coming in the country in general, right?
Exactly. CBP does a ton of our trade and customs, so, mm-hmm. If people aren't traveling in from the country abroad, they're being impacted as well. And obviously TSA being the domestic security agency for our air system has obviously been majorly impacted.
Because there's fees for all those folks have little fees here and there for travel related, airport related, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, the broad majority of our fees may not necessarily be travel-related, but obviously we'll get into that a little bit more.
So you start seeing this. Now we're in April 2020. You said potential $4 billion. That's a pretty big number. So what happens after that?
Right. And so, you do that initial analysis. You kind of have to dig a little deeper. Mm. Obviously, you can't just go to your leadership and say, we have a $4 billion problem. You start breaking those down into a couple of risk buckets, and I kind of highlighted that in the article.
Mm-hmm.
But we a little bit of a high risk, low risk analysis, and so we started looking into, well, what fees are even have an impact?
Yes.
Right.
Right.
What fees can we mitigate with just internal actions, and what are the fees that really, no joke, we can't do anything about? Whether it's legislatively, authoritatively, or we just don't have the resources to address that scale of issue, right? So the first little bit of the programs that we started to evaluate were the programs that didn't have much impact or little to no impact. A good example of that is FEMA's Radiological Emergency Preparedness Program. So they actually end up collecting their funding a year in advance prior to their execution. So in terms of fiscal year 2020, they had already collected those funds in fiscal year 2019. So they were able to kind of continue operations through the end of the fiscal year. Mm. And I think, this is a good point to say, we were trying to just get towards the end of the fiscal year, right? Mm. End of September 30th, 2020. So then we took the next level analysis and said, hey, you're seeing a big decrease in revenue. What does that mean for operations? Are you still able to maintain them? And I think another good example of that is, funny enough, would be TSA.
Mm.
So the way TSA works, a lot of layman people may not know, is TSA does have an appropriation. So their aviation security program is funded by Congress up front.
Okay.
And a portion of that is then offset by their aviation passenger security fees. So whenever you book a ticket, you see a little fee there for TSA.
Yep.
That portion of it goes to offsetting that initial piece of funding. And
right.
The rest of it just goes to the Treasury, right? So all that to say is, while we did see that decrease in revenue, TSA was still able to continue the mission. So if there were people that were still flying because of whatever necessities that they deemed necessary to fly, TSA was there. They were still going to screen people and make sure that our aviation security was intact.
Mm-hmm.
The next case, right, is where CIS kind of comes in. Mm. They're 96% fee funded. They don't have any major congressional actions that kind of continue to sustain their operations. So whenever they see their revenue fall, it's an immediate impact, right? They run like a business, and they're primarily cash driven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because they didn't build up from the prior year. They had to, it's like as you go kind of thing.
They try to have a good amount of carryover going into the fiscal year, but I think they were just burning hot.
When you're 96%, that's not going to last too long, right, if you don't have any money coming in the door.
Exactly. I mean, a good rule of thumb that we have at the department was 3 months of runway.
Yeah, okay.
But, you know, between March and June, it's not a lot of time, is there?
Mm-mm. So were you seeing, was that the component that was getting the hardest hit from what you could see?
I think it was just with the options we had.
Yeah.
Right. And so there are a few ones that we kind of listed out, which is you can monitor it, right? Mm-hmm. I think rep is a good one, some of those smaller fees. You could scale back operations, right? CIS did that. They cut back to the bare minimum salaries and must pay bills. We could reprogram. I think CBP is a great example where, you know, because they're congressionally funded, most of their operations, you can kind of shift some of those non-essentials or, you know, find some change in the couch, if you will, and sweep it over to those other programs.
Mm-hmm.
But CIS just doesn't have that luxury. Just because of the way their fee accounts are set up, their mandatory programs, their fees. So it's very difficult to transfer legally, at least from what we had discussed with our counsel, some of that funding over to USCIS.
So, and just to clarify for folks, so CIS, I mean, there's the citizenship, but do they also do all the visas just for people come here to work?
Good question.
Yeah, and why were they so dependent on fees? I mean, it's basically, that's their primary job, to get those visas and U.S. citizenship fees.
Right. So at a high level, USCIS administers the nation's legal immigration system, right?
Yeah.
And so there are other agencies that are involved. Department of State also issues visas.
Yep.
But USCIS primarily adjudicates a lot of those visas and immigration petitions. So think naturalization, mm-hmm. Employment authorization documents. That is all USCIS.
So, yeah, we're still talking like 3 months into this thing.
Right.
And you're saying they already realize they have a big problem on their hands. So what were the actual, you know, what were the next challenges and steps that they took to try to get out of this thing? I mean, it's a long road ahead. So what happened?
Yeah, absolutely. And so just kind of heading off from that March 2020 point in time, mm-hmm. you know, USCIS financial professionals really just did try to scrub their budgets.
Mm-hmm.
Just really clean them up, see if there's any fat, if you will, cut down to the bare bone. I mean, they even had to suspend their premium processing service, which is an expedited adjudication for certain forms and applications. And so that cut out a whole line of revenue for them just because they weren't sure that they were able to deliver on their services because all their adjudicators had to go home or were, you know, out of the office and couldn't necessarily do their interviews or work. So it was just another added layer of complexity for them. So I think for them at that point in time, this is at this point in time, April, they're talking to DHS. We're meeting daily, weekly, briefing up the situation to the CFO and our senior leadership. But at that point, yeah, realizing that there wasn't much help that we could provide to USCIS, we just had to start reaching out externally for help. So we started getting with our OMB counterparts and some of our congressional counterparts around the May timeframe. Mm-hmm. I believe it was March or May 15th where we actually ended up alerting Congress to the financial situation.
Right. So and then I guess, was that the eventual fix that, you know, got some funding lined up, or what was the final outcome?
Right. So good question. So initially we were looking for a supplemental.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, asking Congress to provide a little bit of stabilization money in the interim. That didn't actually end up being needed, fortunately. So some of our revenue started turning around a little bit. Initially, we were forecasting the need to furlough some employees, up to 13,000 of USCIS's nearly 20,000 person workforce.
Yeah.
Right? Huge impact to real people.
Right.
But I think that speaks a little bit to the testament of how well the financial managers and the budget folks over at USCIS did. to kind of maintain that cash flow just to make sure that their workforce could continue to be sustained. And obviously a lot of that came with a little bit of good luck with people finally returning to submitting some petitions and applications to USCIS.
Right. Yeah, because, I'm sure nobody knew how long. Like you said, at the beginning, people thought, oh, this will be over in 2 weeks. This will be over in a month. And then it drags right. on for months and a year and 2 years. But eventually, you know, people were able to, you know, we had some mitigation and people could actually start, yeah, like applying for things again, going back out or, whatever, you know, go back to work.
Absolutely. And so that kind of bought us a little bit of time.
Yeah.
Fortunately, it gave our congressional partners a good little bit more runway to kind of navigate a solution.
Mm-hmm.
So we were working with them quite closely, obviously, just to try to see what was the best solution. So what ended up happening out of it actually was we legislated a broader use of some of our premium carryover.
Mm,
okay. And so CIS actually has two colors of money, if you will. So a non-premium set that is authorized to be used for broad USCIS operations, and a separate bucket for premium adjudications, which historically was used for like infrastructure and IT improvement.
Okay.
What we ended up with was and was enacted actually was the Emergency Stopgap USCIS Stabilization Act, and that was partnered with both bipartisan agreement with Congress to help USCIS get additional authorities to use some of that existing carryover balance. So now we had a little bit of extra bandwidth to work with to get through the through the fiscal year, because right. that was enacted at the beginning of FY 2021.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess you got to do something. You can't just, you know, this is an important mission, and I'm happy that it worked out eventually. I know it was scary in the interim, for sure. I've talked to some folks at CIS, and that was a very stressful time, to say the least.
Yes.
So, yeah, the furloughs were impending, all kinds of crazy stuff, right? But yeah, and I'm obviously happy that they got through that. I mean, you know, and there's got to be other agencies. I mean, 96%. I mean, what other agencies have such a high, you know, piece of their revenue coming from user fees like that? I can't think of any. I mean, top of my head. I mean,
yeah, me neither.
And if there are, they're not that big.
Right.
You know, like maybe much smaller agencies or some quasi-governmental folks or something. But, but yeah, that's just an amazing issue there. So I guess the question, of course, is, I mean, what do we learn from this? Or is there anything that is being done differently now going forward?
Yeah, so one of the things that we implemented at DHS, and I kind of talked to you a little bit about this before, mm-hmm. yeah. but I don't want to speak as if, you know, DHS was making revolutionary changes or spurs of mm-hmm. innovation. I think a lot of it was just implementing some good practices, providing a DHS fee scorecard that we run up through our leadership. So we collect data set from our components. We set out a projection of what the component expects to collect for a specific user fee.
Right.
We then report out actuals against those monthly initially.
Yeah.
And then we track if they're deviating from those projections and what is the reason for those projections or the deviations
yeah.
themselves. And if there's a remediation action that needs to happen, then that's where kind of headed off at the pass, if you will.
So it's just very top of mind. You got this monthly or very, you know, periodic review and you know, scorecard and the
right.
reasonings and the, you know, why this might be different than it is expected to be. I mean,
mm-hmm.
so that's so very, very is back to closely monitoring things, right?
Absolutely. I'll say this. It sounds simple, but it wasn't something that the department had kind of focused on, right? We kind of, like I said, CIS runs like a business. You kind of leave it to its own.
Right.
Most of budget folks, at least at DHS historically, has been focused on the appropriation side, right?
Oh, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so just shining a little bit of light on this other set of funds at DHS is just a good practice, I think.
Yeah, that's great. That's some risk management right there. I like it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, was there anything else you all did in addition to the scorecards?
Yeah, and so one of the things that we wanted to kind of keep pushing on through that kind of oversight at the department was We updated our DHS financial management policy manuals, trying to set some good standards for minimum carryover balances and fee reviews.
Okay.
Kind of following on that, implemented the biennial fee review. Obviously, that's something that departments and CFO agencies are required to do biannually.
Yeah.
But really kind of shining some more light on it, like I said, from a department perspective, adding a little bit more focus and attention. So just kind of, you know, hitting on the point again about our user fee data capture for our budgets. You know, historically, we just never captured that data or put a lot of focus on USCIS's budget, right? Mm-hmm. So we've kind of said that USCIS is 96% fee funded.
Yeah.
And so in our budget process, we've historically put most of our focus on the appropriated side or the 4%. Well, that doesn't make much sense. Right? Why am I putting all my attention on the 4% and kind of ignoring the 96?
Right.
So what we're trying to do is work with CIS, work with our programming folks, so the PPPE process, kind of, you know, joining all those hands together. So we're now collecting CIS's budget and their requirements into a system. Mm-hmm. So the really amazing part for me is implementing this change, getting USCIS on board to give us their budget and their requirements and their information, linking that into our programming team to say, like, hey, you know, instead of evaluating $250 million, how about another $6 billion that we can maybe take a look at and see what resourcing requirements we can kind of address with that, right?
Right.
And alternatively, right, where USCIS is now trying to push for more humanitarian funding from Congress through the administration, I think that offers a great opportunity for USCIS to speak to that piece of the mission. But on, you know, the other hand, what can we do with the other pieces of that fee funding? Can we invest into more efficient backlog reduction? Can we put that funding into digitization and increase the timeline for that, right? Or shrink the timeline for that? I think that just gives the agency and the department, you know, increased collaboration to really make some big improvements and communicate that to the broader public. But yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that, like, is really, I mean, you know, now you've gone through this, you know what options are out there, you know, if this were to something like this happen again or more quickly, go to what you all did before, you know, like these, you know, your policies are important because when this happens, what are we supposed to do?
Exactly.
It's written down.
Right.
You know, well, I mean, yeah, that was definitely a harrowing little tale there, but just wanted to give you one last question, just any final thoughts either about this or just, you know, about the job you do in general. You know, it's a pretty interesting job there. You had work supporting all these different, you know, components. Yeah. Just any final thoughts from you?
I think we're still continuing to improve on our fee management. One of the strategic goals that the CFO has is to improve the way that we justify our user fees.
Okay.
So one of the, I'll say this is an actual innovation at DHS,
yeah.
Which is we're moving to capture more of our user fee requirements and our budgets in our budget systems, with CIS specifically this year. And I'll say that's been a major success story for them. And so hopefully what this will lead to is a more informed discussion around user fees and how the department can resource agencies, both on the appropriated side, but as well on our user fee receipts as well.
Right. Awesome. Well, Brian, really appreciate you coming here today. And yeah, thanks again. Good story. Didn't want, you know, had to relive the scary years, but no, I appreciate that. And again, it sounds like some great things are going to come out of this going forward, and it's always good. You learn from the past, right?
That's the hope. I appreciate you having me here. Hopefully I did, you know, justice to the folks over at USCIS and DHS. I really do firmly believe that DHS is a workplace of choice. I mean, they let me come on here and speak my little mind. but absolutely. Thank you again.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to go ahead and close it out. And this is your host, Paul Marshall, signing off for Accountability Talks with AGA.